Call to order the House Healthcare Committee for Monday, June 6th, 2011. And first up on our extensive schedule is an informational meeting, State Options under the Federal Patient Protection and Affordable Health Care Act, Oregon Healthcare Ingenuity Plan.
He's mocking you.
Actually, what I was trying to find earlier is I was trying to find a Kevlar vest for you, so... But I have a great deal of respect for anybody who would come in here and talk about a sales tax for healthcare in the middle of a recession. I mean, it's a winning combination, you know. So you're it. But or ingenuity, I forgot, not sales tax.
Thank you, co-chairs and members of the committee. For the record, my name is John DiLorenzo. I'm an attorney at the law firm of Davis Wright Germain, but I am appearing here today on behalf of no client, but as a private citizen to speak about a sales tax for health care in the middle of a recession. And, Mr. Co-Chair, I hope that at the conclusion of my presentation, I will have won you over as a convert.
Have an open mind.
The official name of the program, and by the way, I should also say that I understand that Senator Monis Anderson and Senator Cruz might be joining us too. So I can't see them when they come in, but I'm certainly I'd be delighted to have them up here with the chair's consent. The name of the presentation is State Options Under the Patient Protection Affordable Health Care Act, and what a number of us are calling the Oregon Healthcare Ingenuity Plan. The Obama plan, which is a combination of the Patient Protection and Affordable Health Care Act, which was then later amended by the Health Care and Reconciliation Act, numbered over 2,000 pages in length. It began as a Senate amendment to H.R. 3590, which I have provided to you in your packet. That was a bill that came from the United States House of Representatives that had nothing to do with health care. It was what we would call here a gut and stuff. The Senate placed the health care amendments in it, and it was later modified by a reconciliation bill. Nestled within that 2,000 pages is a section 1332, which I have excerpted for you. It was inserted at the request of Senator Wyden in November of 2009, and it is called the State Ingenuity Amendment. Section 1332, which until about 4 or 5 months ago was fairly little noticed, allowed a state like Oregon to design its own program, to go its own way, to seek and gain a federal waiver, and to opt out of the federal plan. The neat thing about that provision, though, is once a state accomplishes gaining a waiver after designing its own plan, it requires the Secretary to monetize the value of the tax credits and the subsidies, which ordinarily would inure to the benefit of those who were participating through the exchanges, and to then transfer that amount in a lump sum to the state that has opted out for use in its alternative plan. That, Mr. Co-Chairs and members of the committee, is an awful lot of money. I think this presents a tremendous opportunity for Oregon to consider going its own way. Now, those of us who are advocates of this plan and Senate Bill 972, which had the unanimous approval of the Senate Health Care Committee, has a number of overarching goals. First, we wish to ensure that every Oregonian has access to quality health care. That is our first overarching goal. Our second overarching goal is to relieve employers of the debilitating health care obligations and thereby supercharging our business environment, moving Oregon towards a full employment economy. And Co-Chair Thompson, that is the second prong which I want to especially cover today for your benefit. The plan is described as follows. It would consist of a constitutionally dedicated, broad-based sales tax, probably between 5 to 7%, on goods and services with minimal exemptions. The exemptions we're talking about within this plan that have been reviewed by the Joint Revenue Office would be housing, shelter, food consumed in the home, utilities, medicine, and the like, but very limited exemptions. Secondly, because employers would no longer be obligated to pay for health care for their employees, there would be additional income tax revenues which Oregon would recognize by virtue of businesses no longer taking advantage of exclusions and deductions for health care, which they would no longer be providing. So there would be additional income tax revenues that would also be funneled into the plan. There would be redundancy savings of funds otherwise expended for the Oregon Health Plan and the medical side of workers' compensation, because they would all be covered by the basic health plan. We would have maximum federal matching, because this plan would, by definition, cover every Oregon resident, every senior, every child, every matchable person. In fact, it has been referred to as the No Federal Dollar Left Behind plan, because it would capture every single available federal dollar, and the monetized equivalent of the tax credits under Section 1332 of the Patient Protection Affordable Health Care Act. Altogether, it is estimated that those sources would generate between $10 and $11 billion, with a B, dollars annually, which could, according to the Oregon Health Policy and Research Office, provide a basic Blue Cross plan for those earning 200% of the federal poverty level or below without deductibles, and a $5,000 deductible for those earning above 200% of the federal poverty level, which is about $80,000 for a family of four. The deductible is based on the supposition that anybody earning over $80,000 a year for a family of four likely has a job, and that the deductible of up to $5,000 per year could be something shared between employers and employees without having the types of impacts to our economy that current health care does. So why should we do this? First, although there is room for disagreement as to whether health care is a basic right, I know there's been a lot of discussion in this committee and on the floor about that issue, I have come to the conclusion that it really doesn't matter whether it's a basic right or not. I think it is a proper role for our government to protect our citizens from disease every bit as much as it is appropriate to protect them from crime or to provide a basic level of education. I think a good government will do that. Secondly, the federal plan is in trouble, in my view. It may be, components of it may be unconstitutional. You, of course, are aware of the litigation that is pending in a variety of federal district courts regarding whether or not Congress has exceeded its commerce power in requiring people to buy private insurance products. Some federal district courts have said no, Congress is fully within its commerce power. Others have said yes, Congress has exceeded its federal commerce power. That is all destined, it looks like, through the federal courts of appeals and ultimately for resolution by the United States Supreme Court. But even if the plan survives constitutional scrutiny, and most commentators think it is more likely that it will than it will not, it may well collapse on its own. And I think New York's experience is fairly telling. New York State adopted a statute several years ago that required insurance to be priced without regard to pre-existing conditions, without regard to whether people were smokers or non-smokers, without regard to age. And premiums became so expensive that many healthy people opted out of the plan. And what was left in the plan were people who were high users of the plan. In other words, it was a plan filled with sick people. It began a spiraling, which is now known in the insurance industry as a death spiral. You cannot have a plan that seeks to take advantage of the principles of capitation that is only filled with people who are sick. The problem with the federal plan is that if you don't participate, the penalties are $695 per person per year, or $2,085 per family, up to 2.5% of your income. And buried within that 2,000 pages that we refer to is a prohibition on the Internal Revenue Service from utilizing any of its collection authority to collect the penalties, even if they are assessed. And so many commentators feel that evasion or just payment of the penalties will soon be viewed as the most efficacious course, since one may merely wait until one is sick to enroll in the federal plan. We also think that the current system, even if not modified by the federal plan, is likely to collapse. And one of your handouts are a group of charts that Senator Morse prepared. It's PowerPoint, and I'd like to just refer you to one of the pages of it, page 5, where Senator Morse has evaluated the hospital payer mix. And he talks about his slide is entitled Cost Shifting, Where Does the Road End? And what he does is he lists the percentage over the years from 1993 to the present time of the total percentage of health care costs made up by Medicare, Medicaid, self-pay, and commercial. Self-pay, of course, is about 80% charity care. And you'll notice that in 1993, 1994, the commercial policies were paying well over 50% of the total health care costs. Self-pay was always below 10%, usually hovering around 5%. And what he stresses is if three people break their leg and they suffer the identical injury, one person has no job and no insurance. One person is a senior on Medicare, and one person is employed and has a commercial policy. The cost of fixing each of those identical injuries is identical, is absolutely the same. However, the person who has no job is going to pay nothing for that care. The senior is going to have a significant discount on the true cost of the care, and the commercial plan is going to bear the lion's share or is going to bear a premium for the cost of that care. That's okay, assuming the commercial policies stay above 50% of the total cost sharing. But look at what's happening to that line. It is declining, 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 declining. As of 2009, it was down to 40%, and what Senator Morse asks is, when will this payment system collapse? Because as more and more employers are dumping their employees out of their own plans, we no longer have a cash cow available to pay the lion's shares of these costs. So we believe that one of the reasons to study this proposal is because this is the only health care financing plan that can stimulate Oregon's economy. And Co-Chair Thompson, this is the point that this is the point that I am especially excited about. Members of the committee, our unemployment rate today is approximately 11% in Oregon. 658,000 Oregonians, 17% of us, are today using federal food stamps. 35% are earning below 200% of the federal poverty level. That's, again, $80,000 for a family of four. Mr. Co-Chair, this is a disgrace. Oregon is one of the very few states, and the only one on the West Coast, that has no sales tax. Dedicating our sales tax this way would produce about 15 to 20% payroll savings for employers in Oregon. That is huge. Labor-intensive employers would all want to investigate locating in Oregon for a 15 to 20% payroll savings. Who knows? We might actually have factories that could make shoes for a 15 to 20% payroll savings. The additional employment would generate more income taxpayers throughout our system. And, of course, this would not be just restricted to business because school districts are employers, too. School districts would incur 15 to 20% more revenues to devote to education. And, of course, then there would be other benefits. This would be a good deal for Oregonians. Some Oregonians pay, at the cheap end, $600 a month for their health care, and that's at the cheap end. That's $7,200 a year. Well, a 7% sales tax, at a 7% sales tax, somebody would have to buy $102,000 worth of stuff after lodging, after groceries, after necessities, before the health care plan, before the sales tax wasn't worth it. And there would be new freedoms. Freedoms to participate in the arts, nonprofits, start your own restaurant, because you would no longer be tied to your employment. So in conclusion, co-chairs, instead of a piecemeal approach to economic development, I think what we would be talking about here is triggering a rising tide that could raise all boats. Co-chairs, members of the committee, I thank you very much for the privilege of addressing you. It is a great privilege to have us as the only topic on your agenda today. And Senator Cruz's presentation, I, of course, am available for any to answer any questions or field any comments you may have.
Did you bring him for credibility, or?
I hope so.
You bring a senator over, you know, it doesn't always help your case. But,
And vice versa, Mr. Chair. So, okay. For the record, Senator Jeff Cruz, Senate District 1. We've been working on this concept for a few years now, and I don't think it's been a secret to anybody. As we delved into the concept of healthcare transformation, I experienced a lot of frustration. A lot of the frustration was based on the fact that we're talking healthcare transformation, and all we're talking about is Medicaid, and that's not healthcare transformation. In my opinion, the Medicaid system, there's no way to transform it to make it a whole lot better than it currently is unless we're talking in a more global context. But if we do get into a global context, one of the issues clearly becomes how you fund it. And I thought this was a relatively unique approach to funding healthcare. Keep in mind, the fact that Oregonians, as a general rule, don't like to even hear the term sales tax. In fact, I will tell you that I spoke at a Tea Party rally in Roseburg on April 15th, and I had some people relatively upset with me because I would even broach the subject of a sales tax. But I would also say that I was elected to attempt to do good public policy, not be popular. And sometimes those two things can vary. And I'm perfectly comfortable with that as long as I can defend what it is I'm attempting to do. I think if we're going to do true healthcare transformation, we have to go outside of the box that we have been in ever since I've been in the building. Every time we've talked about doing something with healthcare in this building, all we end up talking about is Medicaid. And that's not going to solve the problem. We know that. I would like to see a day when Medicaid and Medicare, as far as the state of Oregon's concerned, no longer exist. And this would get us there. Everybody would be the same. And it would also put things like this insurance exchange in an entirely different light than some have thought about it. It truly would be a portal to let people know what their options are with the dollars that they have. But some of the things that really excite me about this whole concept is the fact that it might give us a legitimate and viable opportunity, for example, to deal with primary care in a non-insurance model. And that really strikes me as something that could be absolutely key to how we truly reform healthcare in Oregon. We had a bill dealing with that because there are some non-insurance model plan or clinics out there now. It would allow us, for example, to create a fully capitated primary care system with a catastrophic insurance product on top, which I think would also go a great way, a great deal of the way, to flattening medical inflation. I absolutely, truly believe that. The more we have explored this, the more excited I have been, and of course, every time I answer a question in my own head, I come up with two more that need to be asked, which is not unusual. But I think one of the things that in all of this work we have done, and it's all incredibly complicated, I think for us to truly get to a healthcare system where there's accountability of all the people, both providers and those receiving the healthcare, if we're going to get to a level of accountability, we first have to get to a level of understanding. And right now, nobody has a clue as to what any of their healthcare costs. Nobody has a clue, you know, they just get access to it. And there has to be a way to make this system simple enough so that even dumb farm boys like me can understand the system. Okay? And I'm a perfect example of, if I can understand it, most anybody can, because, you know, I'm just a simple country boy and I don't know a lot about this stuff. But this is a steep hill to climb. And it's a steep hill to climb because, quite simply, we have to convince the public of a whole lot of things. We have to convince the public that this approach, the sales tax approach, is in their best interest. And we have to convince the public that they can trust us. That's probably the higher bar right there, is can they trust the legislature? The reason we're proposing a constitutional, putting this in the Constitution, is so that we can't mess with it. Okay. Now there are several questions that still remain unanswered, and quite honestly, as I've talked to a whole lot of folks, until we can get to a level of certainty that we can control the cost escalation, no matter what we create, it's not going to work. So at some point in time, we have to get down, will this model, if fully implemented, slow down the inflation in medicine to the point where it's controllable? Mr. Chair, I believe it will. We have a lot of work to do on this. I am suggesting, we had a bill, and it was a wonderful bill, and it's dead. The problem with that bill was I was one of the chief co-sponsors, and all of my bills are dead. So so I should have known that ahead of time and not signed on to it. but having said that, Mr. Chair, I'm hoping that this committee will be willing to join with us in the interim as we explore some of the options and try to answer some of the front-end questions we need to say, is this model, this totally outside-the-box model of healthcare reform, something worth exploring, and is it something at the end of the day that we can convince Oregonians is in their best interest? Chair Greenlick, we've been fighting this battle for a long time, haven't we? And we haven't come up with any answers yet.
We've come up with lots of answers.
Well, we've come up with a lot of answers, but never to the right questions, and that's been a problem. Mr. Chair, co-chairs, I would suggest that this may be a path definitely worth exploring, and I invite you all to join us in the interim as we try to put some definition into a lot of these areas.
How would the basic economics of this work if we put in, by the way, I like the idea of an ingenuity plan better than a sales tax, but if we adopted a 7% ingenuity plan, about $7,000 for $100,000 in a sales tax that, you know, I'm going to pay, how do I get money back? So that's just not additional. I'm assuming there'd be a reduction in the cost of my insurance.
Yeah, we've been...
But would that be because you're talking about $5,000 deductible. If I wanted to buy a policy of to pick up part of that $5,000 deductible, is that going to bring back enough reduction for me that probably won't equalize, but I'll at least adjust that?
Mr. Chair, we have to price a lot of things, obviously. Our vision is that this sales tax would purchase for every Oregonian the primary care component, whether it's insurance or non-insurance. I'd prefer non-insurance. And it would also purchase for every Oregonian a catastrophic insurance product on top of the primary care. Now, if a person wanted something above that in either the primary scenario or the insurance model, they would have the ability to buy up. So, but if the basic is all that you wanted, it would be a total replacement.
So it might pencil out then in terms of monthly payout.
And Mr. Co-Chairs, I might just also share that John DiLorenzo, for the record, I would also share that all these revenue sources together generate about $11 billion annually. Sean Colmer's report that you have shows what that could purchase. This is a financing plan, not a provider plan. This plan could work with a system of vouchers. It could work with something similar to what you're envisioning in the exchanges. It could even work with a single-payer model. It could work with virtually any model. It would raise $11 billion a year.
Total health care costs are now estimated to be about $20 billion.
Right.
But, Mr. Chair, I would suggest that there, if we're you're including unnecessary procedures, never events, all of that is part of that calculation, and quite honestly, we also know that that the reality is that care has to be rationed, and it's going to be rationed in some form or another. And what we're suggesting is in this is that we define what primary care is. We define these things within the budget we have. And I would suggest that most people are going to be probably as well off as they are now, some definitely better. But your ability as an individual to buy up based on all of that is also going to be a component of it.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Doyle.
Okay. This is kind of like deja vu all over again, because in my prior life, the Oregon Education Association twice put a ballot measure on to have a 3% constitutional sales tax. This is before Measure 5. And, you know, property taxes would be lower, commensurate to whatever. And it was defeated quite handily. But we did get it on the ballot twice. And so I guess my questions are, do you have, because first of all, I think it's you don't shut down any ideas. I mean, if we shut down every crazy idea that comes up, we'd still be living in the dark ages, and some crazy ideas turn into be very good programs. And so, you know, I want you to want to make that clear. But has there been any, you know, I don't know, I hate to use polling, but kind of the feeling of where people are on this, and is there like an education component? Because we found out it was, and we could have said, you know, it's a 3% constitutional sales tax. It will lower your property taxes by X. We're going to plant tulips in your front yard and, you know, provide milk every morning to you. And it's still, you know, there was still that fear of it's going to go up. So I guess it's just my question is do you know where the feeling of people are? Is there an education component? That kind of thing.
Co-chairs, Representative Doherty, John DiLorenzo for the record. I've been practicing law now for over 30 years. At the beginning of my legal career, I was legal counsel to a committee called People for a Better Oregon, which was the bipartisan committee that ran the sales tax. I was involved in both sales tax efforts. And I can tell you my view is that those sales taxes went down to defeat because people viewed the sales taxes as being yet another tax on top of all the other taxes we paid. That was their view. That's what the polling suggested to us, too, at the time. Here, I think we are offering a tangible benefit to Oregonians. We are saying this is a sales tax which you should think of as your health insurance premium. You're getting health care for this without regard to employment. You can do whatever you want with your career, pursue your avocation. You will always have your health care, and every time you buy something, you're paying your health care premium. I think the direct connect, the tangible benefit of getting something for a sales tax, might actually make a difference. Senator Morse and I did some preliminary polling a couple years ago. We asked a threshold question. It's interesting. We asked, should health care be a governmental responsibility or a private responsibility? Now, this, of course, was before the recession got worse. 60% of the Democrats said it should be a governmental responsibility. 50% of the independents said it should be a governmental responsibility. 17% of the Republicans said it should be a governmental responsibility. So I've got some work to do on one side of the aisle, but I can tell you that we have gotten a significant amount of Republican support in the Senate over exploring this idea, because we are weaving two things together: health care for everyone and a major infusion to our economic environment, moving Oregon hopefully towards a full employment economy. So I think it could be, I think with the right messaging, I think it could be done.
And a follow-up, sir?
Yes, please.
And I think part of it is, I mean, if you see where education is now and how funding has been so decimated and that there's so much need, yet the funding level just is not there by the state, I think is kind of a good lesson, because we certainly wouldn't want health care to get to that point either, where people can't avail themselves of the health care. They just don't have it. And it kind of wreaks havoc on hopefully the wonderful society we're trying to build in Oregon or continue to keep. So,
if I could add just a piece, because John's made this presentation to several groups, and I'm on the Governor's Commission on Senior Services, and I talked about it a month ago, and they invited John to make the presentation, and keep in mind that these are people that say, never touch my Medicare, and they were intrigued by the concept. This is going to take a huge education effort and a huge marketing effort, but I would suggest that so far the groups that have had the presentation have not run screaming from the room, to say the least, and several of them have been more than intrigued by the concept.
Senator Widener?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Real quick, John and I actually talked about this in the office, and I told you that I kind of liked your idea, but I think sales tax is almost a no-starter for me as one of those crazy Republicans that has crazy ideas that get accepted here and turn out to be great things. But what if it was more of an opt-in program off your income tax? Have we explored that idea to where people could decide if they want to be a part of it, and then you have different plans that, if for some reason the state decides to spend the $54 million building a wonderful website and exchange program that we have set up, where people would have a certain amount of money that they could use to buy the plan that they wanted out of that exchange? Or maybe it's a completely government-run program, but I decide myself, do I want to be a part of this plan or not, and I have 10% or 7% of my income taken out of my income tax for it, but it's that when I check that box, it's for health care. It's not going for anything else. It can't be diverted anyplace else. It goes to the health care plan for everybody to opt into. And then employers at that point can choose to add additional benefit if they want to or not to. But I make the decision. Do I want the extra $500 a month, or do I want that $500 a month to go to health care for myself and my family? And you could almost make the percentage, you know, if you're single, 5%. If you're married, 7%. If you're a full family, 10%.
Co-chairs, Representative Widener, I think that's an interesting concept. My goal here, though, is to advance a broad-based revenue source. I personally feel that income taxes are not a broad broad-based revenue source, not broad-based enough. They do not include many segments of society that are basically tapping into our healthcare system. And secondly, income taxes, in my view, diminish employment opportunities. Higher the income taxes are, especially the corporate income taxes, the fewer opportunities there are for employment. What I was looking for was a broad-based revenue source, which probably is either a sales tax or a gross receipts tax or some other kind of a very broad-based tax, which could then be a shot in the arm for the economy. And the neat thing about this proposal is that it relieves employers of about 15% to 20% of their expenditures, which is what their health care expenses cost right now. Again, that would be a huge way of differentiating Oregon from any other state in the union, and I think would attract lots of employers.
Not 15% of the expenses, 15% of the payroll.
Of the payroll expenses, yes.
The problem with an opt-in is quite simply, at the end of the day, I choose to take the $500, and then I show up at the ED and I get taken care of. And I have, you know, part of this is to get care delivered in the appropriate settings. Number one, that can be a lot more cost effective. And like I said, there's a zillion questions still to be answered around this. My vision of this is this single payer? Yeah, in one form it is single payer, but by the same token, what we're envisioning at this point is that the state's job in this is to collect the revenue and disperse it back out to the people, and so all the decisions are made at the individual level as to who their providers are and where they get their care, and so it's single payer in a different way than what we normally view single payer as. It's not us, the government, telling you where you go or how you do it. It's us, the government, providing the vehicle for the funding mechanism to reach you.
Follow up?
Please.
Which you kind of hit on it there a little bit, but right now government, with the decisions that we make, we're sending them to the emergency room because doctors won't take them because of the reimbursement rates.
Right.
In this body, this session right now, we've collectively said that more, that we're going to cut you more so they end up in the emergency room. And we're not saying, hey, you pay $75 if you go to the emergency room. You only pay $5 if you go to the urgent care facility or to the doctor. And doctors, we're going to give you more for seeing them. No, we are going to cut the doctors more. So I don't see us getting there when we can't do it, when everybody on this committee, everybody on the Senate committee sits here and shakes their head yes, yet we continue to do it, and we have a governor that's saying, you know, I'm going to cut you 19%. So that's where people have a problem with government. And, I mean, as someone who would be in that 17%, that's where I sit. When I'm giving up the money, I want to make sure it's used properly. And we incentivize the right way, but we're scared to tell somebody that, oh, you can't pay $75. It's free for you no matter where you go. Well, no, we have to stand up and make the decisions right here and say, no, you go to the emergency room, you're going to pay $75 one way or another because you paid for the gas to get here and do whatever it took. You go to the urgent care, $5. You go here, it's $75. And we need to be doing that, and we didn't do anything like that this session, and I don't see it ever happening, even with this, and that's why I would be scared to ever go for it. So if we want to start an education process, first we need to start educating ourselves because we know what the problem is and we've been educated on it, but we need to do something about it. And when are we going to step up and do that? And I don't see it happening.
Ms. Co-Chair, Representative Widener, I absolutely agree with you, and it's been my frustration this entire session is we've kind of danced around the edges of where we should be looking, and we're not looking at it. Once again, as long as all we're talking about is Medicaid, we aren't talking about health care reform. And health care reform is a global thing, and part of the global thing is the financial structure necessary to make it happen. And I've had conversations with some of my colleagues in the Senate who hate this concept. And so they'll ask questions, and we continue to talk, and then I'll stop and say, what's your alternative? And I'll ask you, what's your alternative? And I'm not sure there is a viable one out there.
Let me follow up. I think we need to fix the problems that I just hit on, and now you can come to it. It's just like when you sell a levy for a school. When all the people can see, hey, this is messed up and it's wrong, you need to get rid of this, you need to change this. Once you make those changes, people will see, oh, they really are hurting, but they've cleaned their act up. They're running on a shoestring budget. I'm willing to give them more because they're using it wisely. But as long as they see us not using the funds wisely, they're not going to give us more.
Ms. Coach, Representative Widener, I absolutely agree with you, which is why I'm saying we have a lot of work to do before this is truly ready for prime time. But I do think those are issues we can deal with and deal with successfully if under this context. But we have to have our baseline and our starting point, and I think starting from this funding model, it is within our ability to say that primary care docs are the best paid in the system, because we can create the capitated system that makes that happen. I mean, we can do that, but we got to have the structure in place to make all those things happen.
Representative Canavar.
Yeah, I guess the discussion is sort of headed to where I was moving, you know, and I appreciate you bringing forward at least an idea, because it's hard to bring about change in the system. You know, two things about cost containment, I guess, that bother me is one is what are you going to do about charges? I know already a few cardiologists that could spend most of that $11 billion from recent experience. So I'm a little concerned about how you deal with that, you know, and I remember when I started practice, I was charging $35 in 1975, and I don't know, I left 10 years ago, I was $175. Ridiculous. The other piece of this is for all Oregonians, and I worry about adverse selection. My guess is you're going to have a lot of applicants for Oregonians, because everybody who needs a heart transplant or has an issue ought to go to Oregon where there's free health care. And so how do you, and I understand they contribute, but if you're not careful, that ad doesn't take very many transplants or very many whatever it is before you have an unsustainable system.
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Kenemer, let's start with the assumption probably that those who would try to relocate to another state potentially for health care services might be, let's say, the predominantly your Medicaid type population, and I would suggest that if the benefit package that we're going to have is relatively comparable to Medicaid, which it probably will be, the incentive for them to come here to get what they could get in their current state, I don't think is going to be as exciting as you might think.
Mm-hmm. And co-chairs and Representative Kenemer, I would add that one of the components in Senate Bill 972 is a request that the health authority also study the potential applicability and impacts of residency requirements to address just what you have suggested. And if they felt residency requirements 6 months or whatever would be effective, that they would then be part of the waiver request from the federal government under the Ingenuity Act.
Senator Greenleck.
Gee, I have tons of questions. We'll have lots of opportunity. I really appreciate where you're going. As you know, I support this plan. But I was reviewing some of my articles, you need to think about a book I was putting together, and I came embarrassingly across an article from 1972, where I was commenting on Bob Packwood's plan, which is probably the best federal plan for federal, was the FIP of FAP, the family health insurance plan of President Nixon's family assistance program, which, as you remember, was a guaranteed annual wage. So
mm-hmm.
It was interesting. And my comments were that access to health care wasn't a problem anymore, that we had achieved universal access in a uniquely American way with almost 95% of the population covered by health insurance and a variety of other things. And the real problem was money. The real problem was reducing the cost of the health care system. And I was embarrassingly wrong on the one hand, but embarrassingly right. That is still the problem. Everybody knows Senator Cruz lives a rich fantasy life. The kind of fantasies he's talking about the healthcare system aren't covered in this bill. And this bill is a very straightforward bill that is a financing bill, not a question of organizing and delivering healthcare. So the real issue is it possible in one bill or in a package of bills that go together to take that next step and to do things like changing the way healthcare, real healthcare reformation, not our transformation, not what we've done in 3650. And without that, we get into the enormous same problems. For example, with a $5,000 deductible, you have real discretion up to the $5,000, and then you're right back where you are now. I've spent my $5,000, now I want my heart transplant. I want two heart transplants. I want to have more than one heart. I mean, it
I'm not going to touch that one.
Mr. Chair, I want my appendix taken out twice, not once. I paid my $5,000.
Mr. Chair, I would just like you to have one heart.
It's rumored I have one. It hasn't been proven yet.
We will not respond to that.
But, I mean, that is the question. How do we... I mean, there's all kinds of questions on the financing side and all that, and those are very important, interesting questions, but this bill doesn't do anything to do any of those other things. And how do we, I mean, you and I have shared that rich fantasy life when it comes to trading out healthcare. How do we put these things together is the next question.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Co-Chair Greenlich, the reason I brought up my vision of the world is because to sell the financing piece, you got to have the other pieces there. I mean, it truly does, and you can't do it in one bill. It's got to be a series of bills because one's got to be a constitutional referral, and that's got to be, to avoid Armada, we've got to be fairly clear and distinct on that. But the other things can be triggered by the passage of that.
We could have a constitutional revision, is that what it's called?
I'd rather be straightforward.
Yeah.
So.
Probably could.
We could, but you know, people have asked, you know, why do you keep calling it a sales tax? And the reason I keep calling it a sales tax is I'm not going to change verbiage to try to fool the people because they won't buy it. And you're better off just being straightforward and looking them in the eye and saying, this is what it is. That gives you your best chance. And so it's a sales tax, Co-Chair Thompson. I'm sorry. but quite honestly, Representative Greenlich, what you're talking about are the very issues that we need to flesh out before we can even begin to ask the question of the people. They have to know, you know, we can say we're gonna create this sales tax and you're gonna get wonderful health care because we do it. That doesn't work. We have to be able to say, and this is what you're getting.
Mm-hmm. Some of it too is just going to take leadership and determination. I mean, some of the nonsense we put up with, like the use of emergency rooms as clinics, it doesn't make any sense, and it never did, and there's ways to deal with the so-called federal law that demands it. When you send people to the emergency room on Friday night, and they're in the waiting room for 3 to 5 hours, that's not an emergency, and everybody knows it. The better way to do it is simply to mandate that every emergency room is going to have an urgent care clinic across the hall. Mm-hmm. And somebody triages, the real emergencies go this way. If you're not, you're over there. And they can probably, yeah, and they can handle you a lot faster because they're not trying to work with a scraped knee in an emergency room setting that isn't appropriate. And those are things that somebody just has to say, starting next Tuesday, that's what we're doing, so get ready. And I think if we ever straighten out those inequities in the health delivery system, it'll go a long way toward convincing people, now we can look at a financing system. And the basic tenets of the financing system have to start off with, what does it do for small business? If it costs small business more, it's a non-starter. But if it either stabilizes their costs or costs them less, then we've got something to talk about. And then after that, of course, what about the rest of the general population? But I think there's a lot of promise in this kind of system, but we have to have the sorting out the stupidity of the healthcare system attached to this or preceding it, because the people are not going to buy into another scheme to pay for healthcare, the cost of which are out of control. We're doing that with Medicaid. We've done it with Medicare. Anything you put Meta on front of costs way too much because we're doing the activity end of it badly. And I don't even think it's about rationing. I think it's just about changing the scope and methods that we apply to get people the care they need.
And Co-Chair Thompson, you swerved into something when you're talking about services at an ED. I remember a couple of years ago when my daughter fell out of a swing. Her big sister was watching her, which was probably a mistake. But and she fell on her head and on a sharp rock and just a small puncture, right? And, of course, the scalp bleeds like nobody's business. So she takes her to the emergency room. It's nothing. Okay, but the emergency room had to do all of these things, put a staple in. You know, I think the treatment hurt worse than the accident, but they have no choice. And so that gets us into the whole issue of liability reform, which has to be a key component, because if we're gonna require the system to be making discrete decisions, we need to have some protection for the system to be able to do that. I would agree with you. Emergency room should be able to shuffle non-emergent people off to someplace else. You need to have a triage system, but we need to have some protection for those who are making those decisions at the same time.
Right. It's through the whole system. I used to be an ambulance medic, and we'd get calls for an injured child, and it'd be some kid fell down on the sidewalk and badly scraped their knee, and the real problem was mom didn't have any Band-Aids in the house, and that's what they'd admit it. And you roll up in an ambulance with a $1,500 or $2,000 ambulance call to deliver some Band-Aids, you know, and you don't know who to strangle first. But
at least you don't deliver the kid to the emergency room.
Right, yeah, but you know, but yet the next time it could be a serious compound fracture. So it's not a case of you can't roll. It's a case of you've got to get people better informed of how to handle these things and then put a stop to the nonsense. And, then we can pay for it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think part of it, I mean, this whole discussion has to take place. The medical system in the United States it's been so easy for so long because for so many years employers covered health care, and it was very good health care. I remember the days when we had $25 deductibles, and it was $39.50 a month for full family medical, dental, and vision. But those days are long gone. and so it's the cost and it's the care. And there are people in my own family that went far too long with an illness because they couldn't afford the $5,000 deductible. And so they wait and they wait until it was, you know, a much more serious situation. And so I think your ideas, you know, are really admirable. Start thinking outside the box and looking at different things and having that along with the transformation and saying we need to look at this system differently. We have excellent physicians. We have excellent health care providers. It's just the idea of how can we do it better, more efficiently.
And co-chairs and Representative Doherty, what really enthuses me about the potential politics behind all this are a couple things. First of all, Senate Bill 972 was far from an uncontroversial bill, yet it had as sponsors 100% of the Senate Health Care Committee, the Republicans and the Democrats. And it came out of that committee unanimously.
Where did it go?
Ways and Means. But it came out of a policy committee with a unanimous vote. Secondly, it's gotten support from Republicans and Democrats throughout the building. Third, people in this building who represent organized labor are very interested in this bill. Public employee unions are very interested in this bill.
Every CEO I talk to is interested in this bill. People representing small business are interested in this bill. People representing seniors are interested in this bill. I could foresee a campaign meeting someday that was reminiscent of the lounge scene from Star Wars, where we finally have come up, where we finally have come up with something that people from all different points of view might support, maybe for different reasons, mm-hmm. but support nevertheless. This excites me.
John, I think you've done a great job moving this forward.
It has to be a systematic approach, though. I would hazard a guess if we could right now double the income, the revenue for health care, it would be immediately followed by the doubling of the cost of health care and the usage of health care. So you've got to back into this thing, straighten out the health care piece, straighten out the cost piece, and then put in place the pay-for-it piece, and then we might actually get better health care at a better price. But it's not rational what we're doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, like I told the people at the Tea Party rally, I said, this is a study.
Yeah.
And I said, there's a lot of questions yet to be answered. For some people, that didn't satisfy them, but that's okay. I've never been to a conservative rally before where they had picket signs against me, but, you know, it was a neat experience. There were three. So, and that's okay, but interestingly enough, this is a
conservative. You should come to the Democratic Summit.
Well, I've got picket signs against you there, too, Jim.
Yeah, right. But the interesting part, once I got the people that were trying to shout me down to be quiet so I could explain it, and I explained it to the rest of the group, and there was probably 600 people there, the reception was pretty good. So, I think, you know, if we can take the hysteria out of this, if we can get down to this isn't an R&D thing. This isn't political gain. This is trying to change a system so it will work. And if we can put the pieces in place, I have total faith in the people of Oregon to be smart enough to understand that and support it. We just don't have the pieces in place yet.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
If we're going to ease into this, I suggest that we do Native Oregonians first. So they'll be the first ones covered.
Native Oregonians are so healthy they don't.
Well, part of your problem
with
might
certificates.
Part of your problem might be, as I refer to this, as the Cruz sales tax bill. So that may be.
We like that.
Be personal cover, but okay, is there anything else?
Taxation.
I killed Cruz's sales tax.
I know this is going to come as a real disappointment to our many fans. But we will not be meeting Wednesday or Friday of this week. So hopefully you'll be able to use that time as productively as you've been using it in healthcare meetings. We will be back prime time next Monday for something really exciting. Right?
Yeah, this is pretty exciting.
Yet to be announced. With that,
thank you.
And I close the House Healthcare Committee for Monday, June 6, 2011.
John, thank you very much.